This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed by watching some of their work that we weren't previously familiar with. My name is Matt Brown.
I'm Matthew Price.
Today we're going to be looking at the enormous career of actor Albert Finney, whose death hit the film world very hard just a couple of weeks ago. This was quite recent. One tweet that I particularly liked made the breadth of his impact on film very clear. This is from Sam Adams. A thing about Albert Finney is that no matter how old you are, you never lived through a period when he wasn't great, which I think is very accurate and certainly, you know, reflects my experience. Like, no matter how far back you go, if you're alive on the earth right now, he was out there doing some great
pound,
shit while you were watching
pound
films.
For pound.
Yeah. I watched Under the Volcano this week. What did you watch?
I watched Tom Jones.
You watched Tom Jones. A lot of people have been watching Tom. I've been seeing the Tom Jones reviews come in on Letterboxd.
Oh, no.
I cannot wait to hear what you have
say. They've been grossly idiotic.
Oh, great. Well,
for the most part. It's been fun to watch people with no context and zero knowledge review Tom Jones.
Oh, then this
having watched it alone in their room.
Context and knowledge. This is
it's been great.
This is your wheelhouse. This is what you're
a little bit.
Yeah. Criterion put it on the Criterion channel this week. That's how committed they were
it's
to
a part of the Criterion collection.
Yeah, so true, but they've been doing this teaser thing for early subscribers where they'll give you a movie a week because they don't have the full streaming service set up yet, but you can see a movie a week. So this week, it was Tom Jones. Anyway, we will get to the films in a minute, and we will also do a bit of biographical data on Mr. Finney. But before that, roll call.
Roll call.
Roll call.
What is roll call?
Roll call is our monthly feature where we discuss other notable folks that have passed away since the last time we recorded a show, which was roughly 30 days ago.
Ish.
And so as soon as we finish recording a show, the clock starts.
It starts again.
And I start compiling lists of mostly people you will have heard of. But when I find one thing that's a pleasure and a joy about this is sometimes I find interesting people from the corners of history.
I mean, for me, it's an opportunity to learn. I don't have great recall anyway. So sometimes say the name of an actor that I should know and I'll just be like, huh? But then you also come up with, like, this guy invented root beer. And
Jesus.
Who knew someone did that?
Yeah.
The inventor of root beer did not pass away this month, as far as I know.
So we'll get right to it. And I do these just in the order with which I learn them. They aren't necessarily the order in which these people pass away. Sometimes time goes by before someone makes public that a person has died. So there, don't hold me to any. There's no. It's just I write them down as I find them out, guys.
Yep, that's right.
So Kevin Barnett died right after we recorded our last show. He was a very young comedian and screenwriter of some note. He co-created the Lil Rel Howery show that's on the air right now. Was a comedian of some promise.
And he was like in his 30s, right? When he died?
I think late 20s. Not very old at all. Wrote the films Hall Pass and The Do-Over and The Heartbreak Kid. Was, really well on his way to mainstream success. It's fairly tragic. On the other end of the scale, Kay Ballard, who was an actress, not a massively well-known actress, I guess. Like, even looking at her, she was in Freaky Friday, was one of the semi-regular folks on Laugh-In, but a big enough movie star that she hosted The Muppet Show at one point. Mm-hmm. So certainly, somewhat well-known and I think fairly beloved among actors, like seemed like a nice, genuinely sort of lovely person. Tony Mendez.
Yeah.
So do you know who Tony
Wait,
Mendez
no, this is?
Is
not Tony Enki Mendez. This is a different Tony Mendez. You
different,
go ahead.
Different Tony Mendez. Yeah. This is Tony Mendez, the CIA agent.
Right.
Who was among many other things, was the person who came up with the plan to get the hostages out of Tehran by pretending to make a science fiction movie called Argo.
Yeah, this is the Argo guy.
This is the Argo guy. Brandon Truax, who founded and then famously melted down out of a cosmetics company called Deciem.
How did he melt down out of a cosmetics?
So
he went nuts.
He went. He became so erratic that they actually forced him out of his own company.
Wow.
At one point, the Deciem is pretty well known cosmetics company, originated out of Toronto. He was this sort of very charismatic entrepreneur guy, and it just he became increasingly difficult and erratic. The company was sold to Estee Lauder for like a huge amount of money, and eventually they forced him out. And there were these pretty insane rants of him in his car talking into his cell phone that showed up on social media. And he, in quotes, fell from his condo.
Ooh.
Yeah, and that happened this week. So I think, you know, whatever was going on with him, no one could sort of get to him to stop it.
Right.
Jonas Mekas, experimental filmmaker. Russell Baker, Pulitzer Prize winner, host of Masterpiece Theater for many years and a columnist for the New York Times. Douglas Kossel, who is credited as being the architect of the Environmental Protection Act under Nixon.
Great.
This was fairly sad. Again, in a side note, I'm deeply immersed in the Muppets right now for a whole other reason, but many Muppet-related things. Kay Ballard, and then James Frawley, the film director of the Muppet movie.
Yeah.
Also the son of Bill Frawley from I Love Lucy, the upstairs neighbor from I Love Lucy. Also directed episodes of The Monkees, many other things. Anyway, he passed away.
But this is maybe a weird question. Was it top of mind to you that neither Jim Henson nor Frank Oz directed the Muppet movie? Because like that's one of those things that I have known sporadically in my life, but I always had to be reminded.
Yeah, I think I knew because I think I was seven or eight when the Muppet movie came out. That's among the first movies where I was very enamored of how they made the movie. And
yeah.
There were a lot of like behind the scenes things. And I think I always just assumed that they were too busy
being Muppets,
being the Muppets,
yeah.
And figuring out. I mean, they had to on the fly figure out an incredible number of special effects for the Muppet movie to get it to work.
Of course.
You know, watch Kermit ride that bicycle.
It's wild.
It's crazy.
No,
right?
I mean, like, but watch the phalanx of them riding the bikes in Caper.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, how does that work? Yeah. Yeah. So I think I kind of knew that they had another director and you know, I think my perception was that they took it as an opportunity to learn how films got directed because Frank Oz sort of taught himself to direct movies by making the Muppet films.
Yeah.
Dusan Makaveev, who's a Serbian film director, made two films that are actually like pretty important films in kind of the new wave of the 1980s. Montenegro, which is a fantastic movie, and then The Coca-Cola Kid, which introduced Eric Roberts to the world, and is also a pretty fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm.
Film composer Michel Legrand.
Yeah.
Who we could easily have done this month's show about.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Easily.
And also because, I mean, I am a film score guy, but going through his list, a large number of films that I either have not seen or have not seen in so long that I can't remember the music.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that would have been a really interesting pull.
Yeah. Florence Nall Bassett, who was a designer of modern American office furniture, primarily notable because she was friends with Corbusier, and he licensed the Barcelona chair to her for production in American offices. So arguably the most iconic American office furniture, the most iconic office furniture period came through Corbusier and Florence Nall Bassett. And if you don't think you know what a Barcelona chair looks like, you're wrong. You do know what it looks like.
Right.
Alan Cantor, who was I don't know if he passed it down to his own family or not, but he ran Cantor's Deli in Los Angeles, which is pretty iconic delicatessen, especially considering it's in L.A. It's the most iconic outside of New York City in Katz's. James Ingram, singer and songwriter, Oscar winner for Somewhere Out There from American Tale.
Oh, God. That song is haunting.
It is. It's not a great movie, but it's a pretty good song.
That song sticks with you.
Yeah. Louisa Moritz was an actress. One of the women that they bring in Cuckoo's Nest.
Hmm.
among many other things, but also, and I think equally if not more important, was one of the women that was victimized by Bill Cosby and among the first to come forward.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Another person we could have done the show about, except there's only limited time to do our show, and that's Dick Miller.
Yeah.
That guy, Dick Miller, who...
Man.
I don't know, 200, 300 films, crazy, right?
Yeah. A relentless number of films.
We could... I don't think that we would actually have enough time to do a show on Dick Miller.
No, and I mean, also, like, a lot of his work or some of his best work, he's in a movie for 45 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, for me...
And it's the best 45 seconds
yeah,
in the movie.
I mean, I don't know if it's the best 45 seconds in the movie, but, like, his cameo in The Terminator as the gun clerk is, like, I quote that line where he hands the Schwarzenegger, you know, hundreds of dollars of like high artillery, and he's like, any of these is ideal for home defense. Like I just use that line constantly. He was just he was a perfect charismatic scene stealer guy, really good at it.
Just great. And kind of a huge loss. Again, you know, just like our first show with your Harry Dean Stanton, there's certain people that you just think aren't going to die.
Yeah.
And he is one of them.
Yep.
Rosemary Mariner, who was the first woman to lead a naval aviation squadron and later successfully fought and won a congressional measure that lifted the ban on women serving in combat.
Hmm.
I also wanted to take a quick diversion away, since this happened at the time this happened, but February is fast approaching an end. The show will air.
It will be downloadable
towards the end of February, which of course is Black History Month. I mentioned last year that the New York Times obituary section had started a subsection called Overlooked, where they looked at the achievements of women through history who had not previously been the subject of obituaries, and they, you know, the idea was it was an effort to redress that and write obituaries for women throughout history. They expanded that section for Black History Month to include a large collection of Americans of color, Black Americans, who also have been overlooked in history. So, again, well worth taking the time to look. The work they're doing that coincides with us doing this show, but the work that the New York Times is doing on their obituary section is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to our list. Michael Ferguson, Canada's Auditor General. I think sitting Auditor General at the time.
Was he?
That he passed. He was only 56.
Wow.
Julie Adams, an actress, most famously notable for being the female lead in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Ah, yes.
So you've seen her on the posters, you know, the creature carrying her.
Yeah.
Not a death, but I did want to point out that we are extending best wishes and thoughts to Sion Sono, the Japanese director who had a fairly debilitating heart attack.
I didn't hear that.
This month, so hopefully he will be okay and
not
the subject of our show.
Yeah. here's hoping March is not about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll send him a gift basket that says that.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you haven't seen Sion Sono's work, that's worth at least a couple of looks.
Oh, man. Yeah. Watch Cold Fish. It's so good. John Dingell. So this was a loss on Twitter
among many other things. Guy. I didn't know that's how you pronounced his name.
Or Dingle, maybe.
It could be Dingle.
Maybe could be Dingle. I am guessing.
What a charming ass old dude.
Just the greatest, right? Anyway, he longest serving member of Congress in history. And I said, and a hell of a Twitterer.
Hell of a Twitterer. Was active literally to the end. Dictated a sort of like a message to America from his literal deathbed, like 2 hours before he died, to his wife, that was printed in, if I'm not mistaken, the Washington Post the next day. Like, this guy, what he takes service to his people to the highest possible standard.
Yeah,
just
incredible.
A great, great dude.
Frank Robinson, member of the Baseball Hall of Fame, the first Black manager in baseball history, hit 586 home runs. Author Rosamund Pilcher, of course, Mr. Finney passed away this month.
Yep.
We're going to talk about it today.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Two notable Disney-related deaths. So Ron Miller, former CEO of Disney.
Yeah.
produced The Rescuers, the Love Bug movies, The Shaggy Dog, Tron.
So basically the Disney of my childhood.
The Disney of my childhood and yours, famously ousted and replaced by Katzenberg, Eisner, and Welles. But he, in his time, created Walt Disney Home Video and also created Touchstone Pictures.
Yeah.
And then the other Disney death happened a little later in the month, so I'm skipping down and ahead. But Dave Smith, who was the first Disney archivist and created the was you know, an early pioneer in the idea that people should, you know, be archiving this stuff.
Right. Yeah.
Like saving it.
Yeah.
And apparently there was a sort of a catchphrase on the Disney offices and backlot to just, oh, you don't know something? Ask Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Dave knows.
Yeah.
And then two very notable children's authors, Jan Wall and Tommy Ungerer, both passed away this month as well. And Tommy Ungerer, especially, probably my favorite, wrote children's books and then also wrote books of eroticism for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And when
that's how to do it.
When asked, you know, how do you square the circle on writing books about sex and writing books for children, he said, well, where do you think all these children are coming from?
That's right. Also, why would the idea of that division be confusing to anybody? It's like, you do the stuff about sex, not for kids.
Right.
And then there's the stuff for kids doesn't have sex in it. Like, it's a very there's no overlap in that Venn diagram.
You would think. C.Y. Lee, who was the author of Flower Drum Song. Lyndon LaRouche passed away.
Who's that?
Lyndon LaRouche. Who, for fans of U.S. politics, Lyndon LaRouche ran for president something like every election from 1964 to, like, 1990. A nut job to end all nut jobs and always ran as, like, a fringe candidate. Mm-hmm. He's quite well known, actually, in sort of political circles. Anyway, yeah, he passed away. We lost Bruno Ganz.
Yeah.
Most famously, the angel in Wings of Desire, one of my four favorite films of all time.
Yeah.
Many other things.
Well, depending on what generation you're in, because to us, absolutely, the angel from Wings of Desire.
Sure.
To anybody who's been on the internet in the last 20 years, the very angry Hitler.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's
placed
Hitler
in
downfall.
Like,
well, only
neat,
in the sense
you know?
That this is now his legacy is a fucking meme.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the only reason I think it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
I'm sure that movie's good.
But
I haven't seen it. But.
In this weird era that we're in, is it so bad to be considered a meme? Like, I don't know. Maybe that's high watermark for achievement.
You know,
I hope I become a meme before I die.
I mean, Bruno Ganz acted in a lot of stuff.
Oh, the guy was terrific.
Incredibly magnetic.
He's just terrific.
Great personality.
Yeah.
And
Boy,
watch his work after he... I mean, I truly think that the scenes in Wings of Desire after it goes to color and he sort of comes to the mortal life are among the most profound things ever made about what it means to be alive.
Yes.
And he is a huge part of that.
Yes. This is, I mean, you guys, if you want to be a little teary, go read Twitter the day that a guy who played an angel perfectly dies and goes to heaven.
Yeah.
It's really hard stuff.
It
like,
is.
It's, like the Criterion Twitter account made me cry. That's never happened before. They sell DVDs.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, yeah, he was very good in that film.
Yeah. James Dahl, who is a film director, who I think we actually saw in person. He directed The End of the Tour, the movie about David Foster Wallace.
Oh, my God.
We saw at Ebert Fest.
We did. Was he there?
I think so.
Yeah.
In any case, he died. He was only 40.
Wow.
Yeah. Betty Ballantyne, a publisher. She, along with her husband, co-created Bantam Books and later Ballantyne Books, and she is essentially credited with popularizing the pocketbook paperback book format.
Yeah.
Which I think is amazing.
Yeah.
Imagine a world without paperbacks that you can buy to take on the airplane. I don't know. It's just incredible.
It's perfect.
Lee Radziwill. Youngest sister of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, Onassis, also in publishing, married for a time to director-choreographer Herb Ross, passed away, I think, in her 90s, but maybe the last link to Camelot. Karl Lagerfeld.
Yeah, that was just yesterday?
A couple days ago. I have written here fashion designer and icon, also terrible human being.
Sounds like he was awful.
Really.
Yeah.
Really terrible. Beyond what was necessary.
Yeah.
And then I think just yesterday, another baseball death, Don Newcomb, who was a teammate of Jackie Robinson's, one of the first black pitchers in baseball, won the MVP, won Rookie of the year that he started, and was the first Cy Young Award winner.
Hmm.
And that is Roll Call.
And also just yesterday, John Wayne died a second time.
Come on, man. Come on with that nonsense. What, are we canceling John Wayne now? Give me a break.
Well, I'm of the opinion that you either had to have canceled him many, many years ago, or you're not going to cancel him.
We all know.
Apparently not.
Are people going to publish an interview with Picasso? What is next?
Look at Hannah Gadsby's show about her Nanette show. She mentions that we still talk about Picasso in these glowing terms, and that he, you know, was molesting underage girls and all.
Of
these
course
horrible
he was.
Things, you know, but like, yeah,
no
like,
one's denying.
Do people know this? That's the question. Yeah. Do people know this?
But clearly, they don't.
My
assumption is always, of course, we know
it. Yeah, but you know, we're not all trivia buffs.
I can't wait. You know what? I can't wait for people to find out what kind of racist shit Marie Curie thought.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
How far back are we going to go here?
Very far.
You know what? That Solomon was a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Like, come on, guys. Yeah. That's enough.
No, this is good because this ends with people realizing that Jesus wasn't so great. And then the whole house of cards comes down.
Well, I don't know if that's true.
That'd be great. Geez, wow. So we're deep in the show. We haven't even got to Mr. Finney. Let's do a quick rundown the bio of Albert Finney. So he was born in Lancashire in 1936, studied acting at the Royal Academy for the Dramatic Arts, and he graduated in 1956, which, if my math is correct, makes him 20 at that time.
Sounds right.
So he does a bit of TV and a lot of theater, obviously, but his first film is Tony Richardson's The Entertainer in 1960,
yes.
In which he was playing Laurence Olivier's son. Then his breakout, same year, I think, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, produced by Richardson. And then he's also in the film that you're going to talk about, Tom Jones, directed by Richardson.
Yes.
So really, he owes his career to this man, Tony Richardson.
Well, he has a good partnership with Tony Richardson, who's a great, kind of a little bit forgotten, but great filmmaker.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you know that he was cast as T.E. Lawrence in Lawrence of Arabia and turned it down?
Not surprised at all.
Yeah,
yes, I think I did know that.
He didn't want to sign the multi-picture contract that Spiegel insisted he
sign. I know that O'Toole was way far
way
away
down
from
the
first choice.
Yeah.
Not even close.
I think he was like seventh on the list.
Yeah, he was not a well-known. They needed somebody big from the stage, and he was not at the time. I wonder if Richard Harris turned it down.
Probably.
Yeah. A lot of people were sort of in that. What's his name? That was married to Elizabeth, Richard Burton, turned it down too.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Anyway, so he, like I said, he stars in Tom Jones. Tom Jones wins the Oscar the year after Lawrence. He and Michael Medwin formed Memorial Productions in 1967. They produced a few films, including Lindsay Anderson's If...
Yep.
He played Hercule Poirot. He played Scrooge.
Yep.
He played, I think, the only live-action Scrooge in a movie where the actor is young, playing Scrooge in old age makeup.
Are we
so
counting
that the flashback sequence? I'm not counting Jim Carrey, but
no,
so the
no,
flashback
I'm not counting Jim Carrey.
Sequences.
No, no, no.
Are, this I'm I think
saying,
was just a really.
Are we counting Henry Winkler?
American
Christmas Carol.
I don't think I even aware of.
Oh,
American
that's
Christmas
the
Carol.
Best one.
No,
next
think, that,
on your list, sir. This
not,
Christmas,
I doubt it.
American Christmas Carol is the best one. Henry Winkler does the exact same thing.
What year was this?
It was produced at the. He got it made because he was on Happy Days and could get something made. So it was like maybe early '80s. It's tremendous. It transposes it to the United States.
Right.
Obviously, Winkler is incredible. And he does the same thing. The age makeup's great. He plays Scrooge as old. Anyway, go back to your...
So anyway, my point is, like, just not having
any
idea...
Sorry, any chance to talk about that movie, I will take it. It's
fine. Maybe Henry Winkler will die next.
No!
Well, you don't know. I just watched Scrooge for the first time this Christmas.
I watched it just recently.
And it's wild. That's a very bananas
movie. It's pretty good.
Yeah. But I thought it was just such an interesting way to approach sort of the fundamental problem of the before you can do de-aging and the Irishman and all that shit. I thought it was an interesting way to approach.
By the way,
the
I'm
going to
describe
problem.
All movies from now on as it's pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. Great. So he obviously does character work through the 80s and 90s. He kind of comes back into fashion at the end of the century with Soderbergh grabbing onto him for Traffic and then Aaron Brockovich. And then he starts getting cast in like franchise roles. So he's in the Bourne movies briefly. His final screen appearance was in Skyfall, playing James Bond's the housekeeper of the house where James Bond grew up. And, of course, that was the role that was originally conceived to be the cameo by Sean Connery in that... that 50th anniversary Bond film. Thank God, Connery, it went to Albert Finney.
Did Connery turn it down?
No, they never actually took it to the offer stage. They realized that that idea
was idea.
Ridiculously
yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
That would destroy the end of that movie if that guy showed up
yeah,
out of it. You know that moment like where he comes out of the shadows and you're just like,
hello.
Oh my God, what is this? Yeah, can you imagine if that had been Sean Connery?
Hello,
Albert Finney. So he died just a couple weeks ago at the age of 82, chest infection. He received 5 Oscar nominations, had never won, including one apiece for the 2 films that we're going to be discussing today.
Yep.
He was nominated for 13 BAFTAs and won 2, neither of them for the films that we're going to be discussing today. It's also worth mentioning that he never attended an Oscar ceremony where he was nominated because he said he would need to take too many smoke breaks. So he would always be outside, never be in his seat. What would be the point attending? Should we start with Tom Jones?
We can. Can we talk about his career a little bit, or you want to just
sure.
go right into
what do you
the
want
films?
To talk about, man?
I just think it's interesting. So I did more than just watch the movie we're going to talk about.
Of course,
Because I felt like I had some gap. I had seen a bunch of his films, and there were a whole bunch I hadn't seen. And
sure,
I thought, but I just think it's a fascinating career because if you look at, he is clearly a beautiful man, like physically arrestingly beautiful as a young man, really gorgeous.
Yeah,
And
the weirdest thing in the world is that when they made Big Fish, Tim Burton's Big Fish, they cast Ewan McGregor as his son and not Joel Edgerton, who looks exactly
like him.
Him.
Yeah,
like uncannily, almost a clone.
I'm not sure Edgerton was around.
Like he was. He
oh,
was.
Okay.
He was just starting to break out. He had done Star Wars, I think, 3 years before at that point, and he was starting to direct. And I mean,
okay.
In 2005, you absolutely cast Ewan McGregor. But it's still like, in terms of
good
actors who look exactly like Albert Finney,
there's
one.
Yeah.
It's Joel Edgerton. Anyway.
I find his career progression interesting because he went away from leading man roles. So he did leading man roles and did them brilliantly. And I guess, not every actor has this muscle that they need to, or this itch they need to scratch, but he needed to do character stuff. And so the stuff he does in Scrooge and especially Murder on the Orient Express is so amazingly buried underneath makeup and and affectation, and it's great to see someone say, "I'm going to throw off all the." And then he sort of came back to leading man stuff in the early '80s, and I watched 2 films, one of which is not very good, and that film is Looker. That is a terrible movie, terrible. But it's sort of, but he's good in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible movie. And then another one, which I actually think was a pretty good movie, Wolfen. Which is a pretty good movie about werewolves that
Wolfen.
He plays the lead in. It's very
He's
good.
He's the lead in
He's
that.
The lead in Wolfen, and it's actually like, I was so pleasantly surprised. It's made in 81, but boy, it feels like a movie made in the 70s. It's like a weird, almost like a sequel to Taking a Pelham 1-2-3. It has all the same actors in it, except for the leads, and like same type of New York City, sort of 70s, sardonic. New York City is broke in the movie. Like, it was very enjoyable.
Wolfen.
And then goes into that, like, later phase of his life where he's more, like, where he can play old man parts as an old man. Right?
Yeah.
But I think it's, like, beautifully sort of, like, constructed career in the sense that he got to do everything. If you watch the breadth of his performances, there's a lot going on. So
Anyway,
that's...
And he's always, like, I mean, you said, but, like, he's always great. Right, like
he's
one of those actors.
Not great.
Whatever the size of the part, like that guy turns up, you're like, oh shit, this is terrific, good.
There's a film he made in the early '90s that I tweeted about because I thought it was going to get forgotten, and it sort of did. It was called A Man of No Importance, and if you can watch that movie and not,
well, it got forgotten because it's of no importance. Sorry,
it's okay. Anyway, that is an incredibly affecting movie about an older man who is gay and not. And comes to realize it about himself. It's lovely. So He's always great. Always great. Yeah, you want to talk about Tom Jones?
I mean, we can, or we can go to Under the Volcano.
Why don't we talk about Under the Volcano?
Let's do Under the Volcano, because it keys into something you just said, which is that like he's not using makeup in this, but that is he is the lead character. He's a leading role. Yeah. That is an incredibly characterization driven performance, because he is playing so drunk in every moment of that film that you get a contact high just watching it.
He's like almost comatose most of the movie, right?
He is, and it is, I think, one of the most accurate depictions of just the physical behavior of alcoholics I've ever seen.
Yeah. And not like dilettante. He's a deep alcoholic.
No, he's a deep alcoholic, and Finney is not caricaturing it at all. It is very true to the actual way your body starts to respond poorly. Like, he does there's a moment where he runs out into the street to go shopping and falls over and passes out. And, I mean, Finney did it. Like, it's all done in a one. He nails it. It's not funny. It's not, like, it's perfectly, flawlessly. His body just didn't work right, and he goes down. And he's like that throughout the whole movie. And the result is, you know, it's I found an incredibly compelling portrait of a person who is not a good person. Like, I mean, I don't think this is, but he is so ill, he is so sick that it is impossible not to feel enormous empathy for this man. Like, just the depth to which he is in pain from moment one. Like, Finney communicates the basis for the various bases, because it's not just one, but the various bases for his pain perfectly, while also communicating that he is a man with an illness. The illness is addiction. There is no cure. He's not going to get better. He's not going to do all, like, you realize very quickly, even without context, you're going to watch the last day of this person's life.
Yeah.
And it's just a great, incredible performance. Really, really wonderful.
Yeah. And it's part of, you know, part of it is, I think John Huston never, ever not turning in something considered and great.
Yeah, I mean,
all
that,
through the 80s,
The wildest thing about, well, not the wildest thing, but one of the things that is the most, one of the reasons I wanted to watch this movie is that there is nothing weirder to me than the fact that these two guys made Annie and Under the Volcano back to back.
Was it back to back?
It's back to back. Like, that's
for
how,
both of them?
Yeah, like, that's how they decide to spend their time together, is we're going to make this,
like,
musical where he's basically playing a cartoon, and he does it very well.
Oh, he's a tremendous Daddy Warbucks. It's not a great movie, but he's a tremendous Daddy Warbucks.
And then he goes and he does this. It's just incredible work. But you're right. Like, Huston finds the center of this thing.
All I can think is that sitting around on the set, Lowry's work must have come up, and they must have said, "Oh shit, we should just make them." You know,
now,
like,
I have not.
I get it from who those guys are, not from Annie, but from who those guys are.
Yeah, no, but I have not read the book, but, like, one of the things I was reading about Under the Volcano is that, you know, it is one of those novels that many considered to be unadaptable. Certainly, the script that they end up writing, just in terms of how it has to draw the narratives of, like, what has happened in the past, how he got to where he is, the things that are causing him anguish, the things that are going on politically in the country at the time. It's a very complex script. It's extremely well done. But it's one of those things where if you don't hand it to the right actor, if the commitment isn't there, and if there isn't the ability to really work on multiple levels in the performance, which Finney absolutely does, you couldn't pull it off. You know, it's just, you're spending too much. It almost feels like a play. Because it almost feels like a movie that is adapted from a play, because it really does just focus on the three characters, Finney, his wife, and his half brother. But, you know, it is wonderfully cinematic, and again, it has these moments of performance that are just piercing, you know, stunning to look at. So I'm calling that one a win. I certainly enjoyed it. I wanted to watch the one that you recommended.
I was really jealous that you got to watch it. I saw Under the Volcano a while ago because I was not for Finney, more for Huston, because I was trying to watch as many of those films as I could. But
But I wanted to call out the name of the other guy, because I feel like I should know who the hell he is. But Anthony Andrews, who plays the half brother, is fucking terrific, and that is a difficult role to. It reminds. This is going to sound like an awfully trite thing to say, but you know how good James Marsden is in Superman Returns of playing the other guy that you like anyway because he's actually a really good guy. Like he's not a dick, you know. Like he it's the same trick here where it's like that structure, that dynamic doesn't work unless that guy's actually a pretty good dude and he's well played, and that's the case here. It's really, really nicely done. And Jacqueline Bisset is obviously wonderful as well. So it's a really nice cast that Houston put together there.
Yeah. Amazing to me that he did a lot of good work in the 80s. Finney, but yeah, that's a special treat.
Mm-hmm.
The film that you didn't get to
is Two for the Road. Yeah.
Stanley Donen's greatest film, the best film I think ever about marriage, and has in common with Tom Jones a formal experimentalism that I think was at its height in the 60s. I do not love the 60s as a sort of overall decade for film, but I think it is probably the weakest for me in terms of overall output of stuff. But what it does have going for it is a lot of willingness to throw things out and try new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, segues nicely to Tom Jones, which
sure.
I thought.
Tell me all about it.
So the reason I said, oh, the people on Letterboxd. Tom Jones is... please correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't do an exhaustive search. I think it's the only outright comedy to win Best Picture. I could not think of another
Annie
straight
Hall?
Comedy. Okay, Annie Hall. All right, there you go. There are very few.
Yeah,
comedies,
no, it never happens. Yeah,
that win Best Picture. There are films that are funny,
mm-hmm.
but there are very few comedies that win Best Picture, right? And so. For many reasons, mostly because I think people don't generally understand how hard comedy is or how
sure.
important it is or whatever. But as a result, it is a comedy. It is meant to be really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so like many really funny things, it depends on watching it with more than just yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like... I understand that everything should just stand on its own, but it's not as much fun to watch comedies if you're alone. Surprise, surprise.
I mean, I completely disagree, but okay.
Well, you're unusual in that respect, but I do think the film depends on a kind of community of watching it that maybe isn't there if you're approaching it as, oh, this film won Best Picture. I wonder what it is. Right.
Well, it's the film that won Best Picture the year after Lawrence of Arabia. It's got a weird place in cinematic history, and I think
a lot of
cinephiles now would approach that with a set of expectations that perhaps are not fair.
We still approach
Best Picture incorrectly.
Yeah,
because
we
still think it's the best picture.
Right, right. And actually, there's a great, just a side note, but there's a great Twitter thread by Guy Lodge, who's not a guy that I read frequently, but I think is an interesting person, and basically saying that just the act of winning Best Picture will make a film among film people, will make those people say that the film is middlebrow, even if they liked it before it won Best Picture.
Sure.
That winning Best Picture actually creates... a negative connotation
sure.
on a film that it doesn't actually have because of the award.
Except for Moonlight. And the only reason for that was the mistake calling the win that night that Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway did.
If that
had gone straight out, no. Because we all experienced that moment, Moonlight will always be the only perfect Best Picture win. End speech. Continue.
We'll see. It's been 2 years.
It will last. I know.
All right. Good. So it is a comedy, and it is an incredibly innovative comedy based on adapting a novel that is very difficult to adapt. And what I most loved – so first of all, what I most loved about it is just how funny it is because it is a movie, a period piece about England that never stops pointing out how corrupt and foul England is.
Mm.
In every way, everyone in it is a boor and a horrible human being, and there's such delight in how there's all these scenes of people eating these giant joints of meat that are so disgusting that you they're like holding these big fat laden bones out in front of, and it's just, it's great. There, the Lord guy that's like the father of the woman that he falls in love with is an unmannered, gross leer. Like just he ruts on screen. It's my favorite performance in the movie is the guy that plays that character, who, if he's not drunk and falling over a haystack, is like, it's that kind of humor. It's very broad, but it's so funny. But also, just from a stylistic point of view, the movie pulls out all the stops. It starts as a silent comedy. It seems to exist as a kind of a bridge between earlier British humor, sort of like Carry On and Music Hall and that kind of broad British humor. And you can see the foundation being laid for like Monty Python and what's going to come after. You can see it. The seeds of it are there. His performance is brilliant. It's very funny, and it's an incredible indictment of class and quote unquote society. And like, it's got so much to say, while still being so funny. So it's really dismaying to me to see people write reviews that are profoundly missing the point of it, I guess.
They don't dig it.
Well, they just...
I can't speak for them. I haven't seen it, and they're
not
here.
I just think it's like kind of... It's a shame, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's so much greatness in it. And it absolutely, I think, and especially because if you look at 1963, it's a weird year.
Yeah.
The other nominees are not particularly strong. The one film that I think probably should have won was not nominated. The Great Escape was not nominated for Best Picture, which I'm blown away by. I mean, I think if there's a movie where I could have fairly said, oh, well, clearly this is the Best Picture, it's The Great Escape. All the other films from 1963 that are now prominent are either films that were made in other languages, so at the time would not have even been considered for Best Picture.
Sure.
Or are films that have risen to prominence over time but are not, I think, were not at the time considered to be important. So it's not surprising to me at all that it won. I think it's surprising to people who aren't actually familiar at all with how things would have played in 1963.
Yeah.
Right?
And again, people don't understand the Oscars. Like they to this day.
Well, sure, but I also think like it's an exciting film to get picked because it's clearly a film made by and for young people. It's a movie that throws a lot of rules out. You know, I would almost argue that it's avant-garde.
Right.
Right. And so that is exciting because when has that? There are not too many times in Oscar history where the award actually catches up to the front edge, and that's one of the times. Right. You know, and then 4 years later, Oliver wins. And it's like, OK, right back to the back of this pack. Right. Like, you know, or whatever. Like it's there are times, there are moments throughout the history of those awards when it's actually on point. And then they don't last very long. So,
yeah. All right.
So that's what I have to say. I highly recommend watching Tom Jones. I highly recommend not watching it by yourself.
OK. All right. That sounds great.
Yeah.
We have not selected an honoree for our next episode, although, you know, whoever that person is, they're either out there right now or they are no longer out there right now. And we'll let you know on Twitter at DeathWatchPod or on Letterboxd at DeathWatchPod what that person is going to be as we get closer to the show. Thank you all so much for listening. You will hear from us next month unless either of us has recently died.
That's it. That's the end.
You got it.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.